Welcome to you all to the PEARS Institute. I'm David Feldman and the director of the Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you this evening. I'll just give it a moment or two while more people join us before I introduce our speaker this evening. It's just bang on 6:30 now, so I'll just give it just another moment or so before we begin. Well, thank you all for joining us this evening for what promises to be an enthralling lecture from Brendan McGeever. Normally, when I introduce our lecturers, I barely know them, but I've known Brendan over a number of years now that he's been at Birkbeck. And when I think of all the things I've done as director of the Institute, I think that attracting and bringing Brendan to Birkbeck is right there at the top of the sort of best things that I've managed to do. Brendan is now lecturer in the sociology of racialization and anti-Semitism at Birkbeck and a research associate at the PEARS Institute. His book, Anti-Semitism and the Russian Revolution, was published by Cambridge in 2019, and this year was awarded the Reginald Zelnick Book Prize for History by the Association for Slavic, East European and Eurasian Studies. In 2019, he was a BBC AHRC New Generation Thinker. So he already has a number of stellar achievements to his name. This evening, he's going to talk to the title Anti-Semitism and the Left in the Russian Revolution. He'll speak for about half an hour, and then he will answer questions and respond to any comments. If you'd like to raise a question, please put it in the chat, and I will moderate and pass the questions over to Brendan after he finishes his talk. Brendan.
Thank you so much, David, for that extremely generous introduction. And thanks also for asking me to be here tonight. It's a tremendous honor to speak at the PEARS Institute, albeit from a desk in my bedroom. And hello to everyone that's here as well. I just also wanted to thank Jan Davison and Tanisha Westcar, my colleagues at Birkbeck at the PEARS Institute, who do so much work in the background to make these things as smooth as possible. I'm just going to start and dive right in at the deep end in the Russian Revolution. When the Bolsheviks came to power in 1917, they famously announced the overthrow of a world that was scarred by exploitation and domination. And this was a tumultuous moment that was driven first and foremost by a quite unprecedented mobilization of class injuries and class grievances. But it was also a project, a promise, that offered deliverance from the injustices of racialized and gendered forms of domination as well. And I'm just going to share my PowerPoint, which I had forgotten to do. Bear with me one moment, please. Sorry, everybody. Here we go.
Technology.
Hope you can see this okay. So, as I said, this was a project that offered deliverance not just from the injustices of class exploitation, but racialized and gendered forms of domination as well. And it was the promise of a world free of racism, in particular, that resonated far and wide and reached a truly global and multi-ethnic audience. It reached, for example, the Harlem Renaissance and the Jamaican-American writer Claude McKay, who actually traveled to Moscow in the early 1920s to take part in the unfolding revolution. And here is McKay speaking in the Kremlin, of all places, at the Fourth Congress of the Communist International. Now, McKay's interest in Bolshevism stemmed specifically and first and foremost from this, from the Soviet government's promise to eradicate racism and crucially from its record in opposing anti-Semitism. Writing in 1919, McKay noted, he said, "Bolshevism has made Russia safe for the Jew, and it might make the United States safe for the Negro. If the Russian idea can take hold of the white masses of the Western world, then black toilers will automatically be free." Now, I absolutely love this quotation, and I try to squeeze it into any talk that I ever give on any subject. So I'm going to do so again tonight. One of the reasons that I love this quotation is that it's a kind of powerful illustration of what we might call a coming together of the Russian Revolution and the Black Atlantic, where a multidirectional anti-racism comes into view. But just as McKay was putting pen to paper when he wrote these words, in Russia itself, the most shocking and explosive wave of anti-Jewish violence was storming through the former Pale of Settlement. And what we're talking about here is the single most violent and significant assault on Jewish life in pre-Holocaust modern history. The most conservative estimates put the number of Jews murdered in the pogroms of the Russian Civil War at 40,000, 50,000. And at the time, Soviet politicians estimated that perhaps 200,000 may have had perished. What scholars today argue is that the figure is surely above 100,000, and we will never know the true number of fatalities. So the Russian Revolution was this moment of emancipation and liberation for so many. But for so many Jews, it was accompanied by racialized violence on a quite unprecedented scale. Now, in much of the literature on the Russian Revolution, anti-Semitism is presented as a form of counter-revolution, as the preserve of the anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist political right. And there's very good reasons for this. The Tsarist regime, as many people know, was defined by its anti-Semitism, and the Bolshevik leadership opposed anti-Jewish violence. But this is not the full story. What was shocking to Lenin and to the Bolshevik leadership was the participation of the Red Army in this anti-Semitic violence. Workers, peasants, Red Army soldiers, mobilized by Bolshevism and by revolution to express their class injuries, had turned on Jews. And this was the task that I set myself when I sat down to write this book. Why was it that the project of class and social justice could sometimes take an anti-Semitic turn? Why was the question of anti-Semitism so profoundly explosive for the Bolsheviks? And why, in certain moments, could it overlap so powerfully with revolutionary politics? Those are the first sets of questions that I tried to grapple with in writing this book. But the book tries to grapple with a second set of questions as well. What did the Bolsheviks do about this? How was the question of not just anti-Semitism, but working class anti-Semitism? How was that handled conceptually, theoretically, and above all, politically, by the revolutionary government? And not just how, but who? Who responded to anti-Semitism when the Bolsheviks responded to anti-Semitism? Who was leading this campaign? What I want to do in this talk tonight is to try to run through the answers that I came up with to these questions in the book. But before I do so, I just want to start by making one thing clear. The Red Army was the least prone to participation in pogroms of all the military forces in the Russian Revolution. There was a classic study carried out in the early 1920s by the Yivo and Yiddish scholar Gergel, who calculated that the vast majority of the pogroms were indeed carried out by the anti-Bolshevik political right. This is a table that he produced in his study, which if you look at the far right-hand side of the screen and scroll down, you will see that Gergel calculated that the Red Army was responsible for roughly 8.6% of all pogroms. In fact, there is good reason to push this figure up to 10 or to 12%. But his main point stands. The vast majority were carried out by the political right or anti-Bolshevik forces, in this case, Petlura's army or the Denikin army, 40 and 17% respectively.
How wrong?
So we can say that, let's just say, 1 in 10 pogroms were carried out by the Red Army. Now, in the book that I wrote, I tried to place these pogroms center stage, not just because they've been overlooked in the literature on this subject, but for the very challenge, fundamental challenge, that they posed to the Bolsheviks and to their anti-racist promise that had reached so far and so wide. Another way of saying this is that when the Bolsheviks responded to anti-Semitism, they were responding to an anti-Semitism that had gained traction deep within the social base of the party and the movement itself. In fact, the very first pogroms to occur after the Bolsheviks came to power were not carried out by the anti-Bolshevik White Army or some other military forces, but were in fact carried out by the Red Army itself. These pogroms took place in the spring of 1918 in various towns and cities of the Ukrainian northeast in the Chernigov region. And the most notorious of these pogroms was the one that took place in Glukhov, a small city in Chernigov. When the Bolsheviks, or the Red Army rather, rolled in to Glukhov on March the 7th, 1918, they announced, "We are here to slaughter the bourgeoisie and slaughter the Yids." They then went from door to door asking, "Where do the Jews live?" Entire families were rounded up and shot on the spot. At the time, a Bundist recalled that the very street on which the local Soviet was based was literally sodden with Jewish blood. After the bloodshed, the red flag was hoisted up in the town square with the slogan, "Long live the International." This was the spring of 1918, and it was just a precursor to what occurred a year later in the spring and summer of 1919, when the Bolsheviks came back into power in Ukraine once again. Now, to write this book, I spent a good year or so in Russia and Ukraine in the former Soviet archives, going through materials on this subject. And one of the most important archival sources that I found were these svodki, which is a Russian word for report, these internal reports written by Red Army commanders to Lenin, to Trotsky, and to the Bolshevik leadership, giving very, very detailed accounts of particular Red Army battalions and regiments across the whole of Soviet Russia and beyond. Now, I went through these reports for the whole year of 1919. And one thing that leaps off the page when you go through them is that anti-Semitism was present within the Red Army in every single province in Ukraine where the Red Army was stationed. And not just in Ukraine, but into the western borderlands of Russia as well. In fact, the situation was so grave in some regions that Bolshevik agitators who wanted to talk to their own Red Army soldiers about this issue could not do so for fear of being shot on the spot or being seen as quote-unquote Yid speculators, one of the categories anti-Semitic categories that you find in these reports. I'm going to quote from one of these reports from April 1919. Political work among the Red Army is entirely impossible. Anti-Semitism is so strongly developed, pogroms have become an everyday occurrence. This was the first Soviet army in Ukraine, one of the largest military formations the Bolsheviks could rely on in this period. And as you go through these reports, one of the helpful things that they do for the researcher is they actually quote what Red Army soldiers are saying. And one of the most common slogans of the period that you find is this one: smash the Yids, long live Soviet power. This was a Red Army slogan from below that Red Army commanders were documenting and writing to Lenin and Trotsky and warning them about. So this slogan fascinated me when I was writing this book: smash the Jews, long live Soviet power. The lines of demarcation that Bolshevik leaders drew between revolution and counter-revolution, anti-Semitism and internationalism, these lines of demarcation were so clear in the minds of Bolshevik leaders. But on the ground, they were categories that were fluid and porous. That is to say, people moved within and between them. So as I sat in the archives and then subsequently at the Peirce Institute trying to make sense of all of this when I was writing the book, I found myself asking a very basic and fundamental question. What does this mean? What is this anti-Semitism on the revolutionary left all about? What are the historical, political, cultural conditions that enabled this confluence between anti-Semitism and class politics? And of course, there's no straightforward answer that any historian can give to these questions. The pogroms were many-sided. They were heterogeneous, not uniform. But there is a theme that I nevertheless try to draw out in the book. And this is what I call the articulation between the politics of class and the politics of anti-Semitism. Now, what do I mean by that rather clumsy phrase? Let me have a go at explaining it. Many in the Bolshevik social base, particularly in Ukraine, fought for a popular conception of Soviet power, a power of the people, of the laboring people. Against whom? Against a set of very clearly identified categories: capitalists, speculators, and exploiters. These were standard categories of revolutionary Bolshevism. Pick up a copy of Pravda from the day after the October Revolution, and you'll find them used on the front page of that newspaper. As far as Lenin and the leading Bolsheviks were concerned, these were precisely the kinds of concepts and categories that would cut through the politics of race and nationalism and lead workers towards class consciousness. But things were much messier than that on the ground. In the Russian Revolution, and in Ukraine in particular, these categories of class were understood on the ground, often in racialized ways. The very word Ukrainian, the very word Jew, simultaneously meant both class and ethnicity to ordinary people. In the popular imaginary, who was the Ukrainian? The Ukrainian was an honest toiler, the kind of person that had dirt underneath their fingernails as they toiled. Who was the Jew in the popular imaginary? Well, they were not the Ukrainian. They were a speculator, an extractor of surplus labor, not a producer of it, in the popular imagination. Of course, many, many, many Jews were indeed toilers. This did not correspond to reality. So the very categories of class and of revolution that the Bolshevik leaders deployed often meant something different on the ground, and they were taken up within social struggles in ways over which the Bolsheviks had little control. And actual class relations played a role in some of this. In Ukraine, at least, 80% of the total population was rural and peasant-based. Just 4% was industrial and working class. And of those, 90% were non-Ukrainians. So Ukraine had a working class that was multi-ethnic, often Jewish, and an overwhelmingly ethnic Ukrainian peasantry. So nationality and class and ethnicity were interlocking experiences for most people. And the national question, as it was called, was felt at the point of production and exchange. So the Bolsheviks tried to counterpose class to ethnicity, but actually for many people, these categories could not be separated so easily. So what happens in the spring and summer of 1919 is the Bolsheviks carry out mass mobilization. They try to recruit peasants and workers and bring them into the Red Army. There's no political screening that takes place. If workers and peasants declare they will smash the bourgeoisie, they are admitted into the Red Army, given weapons and told to fight. And this is a deeply contentious social base on which the Bolsheviks wage the revolution. And it has devastating consequences in the spring and summer of that year as new Red Army soldiers move between these categories of revolution and counter-revolution and move in to anti-Semitic violence. And this is the kind of crucible within which the slogan, smash the Jews, long live Soviet power, could gain such traction. Soviet power was vulnerable to an anti-Semitic interpretation. Which brings me to the heart of the book, really, and its fundamental question. What did the Bolsheviks do about this? How did they tackle anti-Semitism within the revolution? Well, I mentioned an assertion in the literature earlier about anti-Semitism being counter-revolution. There's another assertion in the literature on this subject, which is that it was Lenin and the Bolshevik leadership who led a rigorous campaign against this violence. Well, my book gives a different interpretation of events. In fact, the Soviet response to anti-Semitism, I argue, emanated not from Lenin and from the party leadership, but in early 1918, after the Glukhov pogrom that I mentioned earlier, it emanated from a single institution. This one. This is the Jewish Commissariat, the Jewish Department of the Soviet government. Now, for those that know a bit about this history, the Soviet government had special departments to deal with a whole host of questions, as they were called. The woman's question, for example, was addressed by the Zhenotdel, the women's department of the Russian Communist Party. There were Muslim sections of the party as well, as you can see on your screen. So the Jewish Commissariat and the Jewish sections were part of this broader Soviet approach to tackling minority rights and oppression. And what's fascinating about this organization, the Moscow Jewish Commissariat, is that in early 1918, there was not a single Bolshevik among them. In fact, it was composed entirely by left Zionists, Marxist Zionists, and Jewish socialists. And what I argue in the book is that these activists played the leading and at times only role in initiating a Soviet response to the ferocious Red Army pogroms of early 1918. And in a way then, the takeaway of the book can be summarized in a single sentence. There was a Soviet response to anti-Semitism, but it was not Bolshevik in origin. And I want to just give you an illustration of this. In the month of April 1918, once the news of the Glukhov pogrom had become known to the Jewish Commissariat, they wrote letters to the Soviet government demanding a response. Here's one of these letters I came across in the archive. It's written by Tzvi Friedland, a left Zionist who was the head of the Moscow Jewish Commissariat, who joined the Soviet government after this violence came to light. And he writes this letter to Lenin's Soviet government. The government must take measures, all measures, to stop the pogroms in its own backyard. We invite you, the Soviet government, to take appropriate measures. This is the task of the Russian socialist government. And I want you to note here the flow of anti-racist agency and the direction in which it moves. Friedland's deputy, Ilya Dabkovsky, wrote a letter as well, directly to Lenin. Comrade Lenin, he wrote on the 19th of April, 1918, the Soviet government must once and for all put an end to this provocation. We invite you, respected comrade, to ensure that the fight against pogroms is put on to the agenda. None of these attempts were met with any success. In fact, it was in the face of inactivity from the Soviet government that the Jewish Commissariat took matters into its own hands and established its own institution to deal with the issue. They wrote pamphlets, established an educational program, and carried out lectures and reading groups in the Red Army and in schools as well. So this led me to a different interpretation of this history. The impetus for what we might today call an anti-racist praxis emerged not from the central apparatuses of the Soviet state, as has been assumed within the literature, but from its non-Bolshevik Jewish peripheries. And this happened again in 1919, when a new layer of Jewish revolutionaries moved into the Soviet government, in this case, Bundists, communist Bundists, and members of the United Jewish Socialist Workers' Party, who joined the Bolshevik government in the spring of 1919, and then in that summer led the campaign against anti-Semitism, and in particular led the campaign against anti-Semitism from within the revolutionary movement. Again, non-Bolshevik by background, these were all Bundists and left Jewish socialists. And they set up education courses on anti-Semitism, ran lectures within the Red Army, and established their own institutions for doing so. Okay, what does any of this matter? Why do I think any of this is significant or even interesting? The Soviet response to anti-Semitism, I want to suggest, was actualized and sometimes sustained by a group of non-Bolshevik Jewish socialists. Now, lest there be any understanding here, for anyone who's read their Lenin, he was opposed to anti-Semitism. He even issued a decree about it 3 months after these letters to him had been appealing for action. He also recorded a famous speech against anti-Semitism a year later. I'm not saying the Bolsheviks did absolutely nothing. I'm not saying they were unopposed to anti-Semitism. They were opposed to this issue. Bolshevism had been opposed to anti-Semitism way back to the late imperial period. But once we disaggregate the actual Soviet response to this issue, disaggregate it to the level of agency, we discover that the Soviet confrontation with anti-Semitism had origins that were as particular as they were universal. The move from standpoint to actuality, from stated opposition to an actual articulated political campaign, that move was carried out by Jewish radicals who were either non-Bolshevik or had only recently joined the party. And these revolutionaries combined their political work, their revolutionary agency, with a self-identificatory Jewishness. So unlike Trotsky and unlike other famous Jewish Bolsheviks like Zinoviev, they were less traversed along the path of assimilation and had very real and active connections to Jewish, to the Jewish street, to Jewish worlds, whether that be Yiddish-inflected Bundism or Marxist Zionism. And there was something distinctive about their work. There's an urgency within which they write, an ethical imperative that underlays their work in this area. This was not a response to anti-Semitism that was merely instrumental or tactical. They spoke often from a subject position as Jews. In fact, they engaged with the revolution itself as Jews in a very distinctive way. So who were they? Moshe Rafez, Abraham Chaifetz, David Lipetz, three of these individuals on the screen, all Bundists that joined the party in 1919. They received a Jewish education as children and by their teens were deeply immersed in revolutionary politics. Born amid the tumult of the 1881 pogrom wave, this was a generation that entered adolescence in the slipstream of one of the most decisive turning points in East European Jewish history. So unlike their parents and their grandparents, these young individuals studied not in the yeshiva, but in universities abroad. By the time they're young adults in the 1905 revolution, they find themselves in the throes not just of revolution, but of anti-Semitic violence as well. The historian Jonathan Frankel captures this beautifully, I think, where he writes, they were extremely young in 1905, utterly committed to the cause of revolution and armed Jewish self-defense. By 1906, the revolution had absorbed their every waking moment and every ounce of their strength and hope. But to them, revolution meant struggle, not only for social equality and political freedom, but for national, for Jewish liberation. The Soviet response to anti-Semitism that unfolded a decade later in 1918 and 1919 had its moorings in these biographies, in the Jewish lives through which they were lived out. This was a socialism that was at once revolutionary, proletarian, and Yiddish, and it was profoundly inflected by the actuality and often the experience, the lived experience of anti-Semitism. I mentioned David Lipetz on the far, who you can see on the right-hand side of your screen. Lipetz wrote, Lipetz was in New York in 1917 when the revolution broke and he came back to Russia. But his revolutionary fervor was tempered by a pessimism of the intellect. As a Bundist, he wrote, "Anti-Semitism is double-edged. Freedom and Jewish pogroms have a wild insanity." And this caught up with him, actually, in 1919, when he was in his native Berdichev as the mayor of the town. Again, a Bundist, still in this moment. Pogromists arrived at his house, lined him, his mother-in-law, and his daughters up against the wall and threatened to murder them on the spot. And he only escaped narrowly by bribing the pogromists with valuables. When he tried to bury the victims 4 days later, the pogromists struck again, murdering four further mourners, prefiguring Walter Benjamin's 1940 warning that not even the dead will be safe from the enemy. In March 1919, a second pogrom happened. Lipetz moved to Moscow, joined the Bolsheviks, and helped lead the Soviet response to anti-Semitism in that year. And this is not only a Jewish story. The route from racialized violence to national liberation to communism was a well-trodden path. I started this talk with Claude McKay, the Jamaican-American poet of the Harlem Renaissance. Well, in 1920, McKay wrote, "Although I'm an international socialist, I believe that for subject peoples, nationalism is the open door to communism." Just a few months later, the Jewish section's leader, Avrom Merezhin, a former Bundist, adopted a strikingly similar metaphor to describe those Bundists, like him, who had moved over to Bolshevism after the revolution. "The Jewish question was the door through which they came to us," said Merezhin. So the book that I wrote then tries to make the case that anti-racism does not flow automatically from socialist politics. In the Russian Revolution, opposition to anti-Semitism had to be cultivated and renewed continually. As we sit here a century on, grappling with the damage done to the world by racism and by anti-Semitism, I want to pose a question. Does the revolution, the Russian Revolution, continue still to have some resources for us as we think through the emergencies that we find ourselves in today? I think it might just. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brendan. Absolutely fantastic, fascinating talk. I mean, I've heard you talk about this before. I've read you on this, and every time I'm still captivated by the subject and by your analysis of it. We have many, many questions. I will not ask one, therefore. And although the questions are quite meaty, Brendan, it would be great if you could be more brisk than expansive in your answers so that we can get through as many of them as possible. I mean, that's not to answer them properly, but to restrain yourself from that additional anecdote. So the first question that came in, and a very interesting one, from Laurie Bernstein asks, given the way that the categories of capitalist speculator and exploiter were not only racialized, but also inherently gendered, do we need to take into account other reasons for the violence against Jewish women?
David, do you want me to do these one at a time, yeah?
I think so, Brendan.
Sure, sure. Thank you for this question, Laurie. I should make a confession that Laurie is a very close friend that was on the phone to yesterday or the day before. Uh-huh. I'm not quite sure. You won't have known this, David, but it's lovely to see. It's lovely to see you, Laurie, and thanks for asking challenging questions as ever. I think what Laurie says here is absolutely right. The pogroms very, very often had a gendered dimension, more than a dimension to them. They were inherently gendered in terms of the discourse and also in terms of the outcomes. And there's a new book on this subject by Elissa Bemparad, who's a historian in New York, who has written extensively on the role of rape in the pogroms. It's an extraordinary piece of work that she's done. And she's the one scholar, I think, who's really brought this out most clearly for us, the centrality of gender and gendered violence in these pogroms and in this period more generally. So if anyone wants to sort of take this further forward, I encourage you to read Elissa's book. It's called Legacies of Blood, and it just came out a few months ago.
Thank you, Brendan. There's a question from Lucian Jenkins, which I think is a very interesting question, asks, how does the timetable of Soviet responses to anti-Semitism compare with the suppression of other political parties? And I find it a particularly interesting question because it put me in mind of a talk I heard at YIVO, probably 40 years ago now, by Lucian Jabrzynski, who was talking about Jewish life in Poland. And I asked him whether there was a good time for the Jews in Poland after the Second World War. And his response was probably the first 10 years under Stalinism.
That's fascinating. I think, Lucian, I'm really delighted you've asked this question because you get to the heart of the issue and it allows me to say something that I wasn't able to say in the talk itself. The connection between the Soviet sort of decentralization of Soviet power and the suppression of other political parties had a direct consequence on its response to anti-Semitism. So I mentioned, if you remember, that Zvi Friedland, the guy who writes to the Soviet government in early 1918, the Marxist Zionist, he headed the Jewish Commissariat. He headed its department for responding to anti-Semitism. I think it was called the Department for the Struggle Against Anti-Semitism within the Jewish Commissariat. When the left Zionists are pushed out of the Soviet government after the failed left SR uprising of the summer of 1918, The Bolsheviks' aim is not to get rid of the Department for the Struggle Against Anti-Semitism, it's to get rid of non-Bolshevik bourgeois elements within the government. And one of the unintended consequences of this is that the campaign against anti-Semitism grounds to a halt because there's nobody picking up the work. So there's generic statements about the issue, but again, the move from standpoint to actuality, the articulation of a dedicated and sustained political campaign against anti-Semitism grounds to a halt when these individuals are pushed out of government. That's what happens in 1918. So there's a direct correlation. And it's not until former Bundists are brought into the party a year later that a more sustained campaign emerges again. So you can track and trace the ebb and flow of anti-Semitism, not directly, but to a degree, you can track it against the move of sort of non-Bolshevik Jewish socialists in and out of the apparatuses of government.
Thanks, Brendan. Michael, whose surname I won't attempt, from Albuquerque, asks, how was Lenin's hostility to Bundism, how did it serve as a barrier to serious work against anti-Semitism? Or one might say, did it serve as a barrier?
Thank you for that, Michael. And I think Lenin's actually an interesting case here. Lenin is, in 1919, he's having to balance the work of the Yevsektia. The Yevsektia is the Jewish sections of the Communist Party. These are all former Bundists and Jewish socialists who have turned to communism. And they became the most militant anti-Bundists, many of them. So what Lenin has trouble doing is keeping the Jewish sections in check and stopping them from coming down so hard on non-Bolshevik Jewish socialists. In fact, in the summer of 1919, as these new these former Bundists are moving into the party, Lenin writes to the head of the Jewish sections, Dimanstein, and says, "Go easy on the Bundists; they've had a rough time." So Lenin's a kind of, to a degree, a friendly face for these, certainly friendlier than their former Bundist comrades who are out to show them as being national chauvinists and bourgeois deviators and so on and so forth.
Thank you.
And of course, Lenin was completely opposed to anti-Semitism. So, you know, Bundists had good reason to reach out to him.
We have a question from Shirley Franklin, who suggests that you're perpetuating a myth of anti-Semitism on the left. Do you want to respond to that, Brendan?
Well, I find it hard to respond to. I mean, I sat in the archives, Shirley, in the former Soviet archives. In fact, I'll tell you actually a little bit about how this worked. This was my complete naivety as a scholar. I went into the Moscow archives. I sat down. I asked for the inventory, the files, and I looked for the word anti-Semitism, and it was nowhere to be seen. I looked in Lenin's files in the inventory, anti-Semitism, nowhere to be seen. It was nowhere. And I began to panic. Maybe this is a myth. Maybe this stuff never happened. Maybe the Bolsheviks didn't document it. And of course, I looked up a different path. I looked up counter-revolution or hooliganism or anti-Bolshevik tendencies, different categories of in the archives. And each document I opened was teeming with empirical evidence of anti-Semitism. And remember, these are Bolsheviks writing to Lenin. In these reports I mentioned, these are committed revolutionary Bolsheviks, Jewish and non-Jewish, writing to Lenin and saying, we have a problem on our hands here. So there is no way in which we can characterize this as myth. The Bolsheviks responded to anti-Semitism, and they responded to an anti-Semitism that had gained traction within the social base of the party and movement itself, and it cost lives. For example, many of those left Zionists and Bundists who joined the Red Army in 1919, whole sections of these organizations were simply murdered by counter-revolutionary forces, but also they were murdered by Red Army sections which had broken free and turned against Jews. So we simply cannot characterize this as myth at all.
Thank you, Brendan. Michael Hahn asks, was anti-Semitism mainly in the Ukraine, or did it spread further east?
Hi, Michael. Thanks for that. And I realized that every example I gave was from Ukraine in the talk, and there's a reason for that. What I called articulations between class politics and anti-Semitism. And I don't mean articulation in the sense of like something that's voiced. I mean it more in the sense of a join, an articulated join between two things. That confluence takes place across the former Russian Empire, including as far east as Siberia. But it takes a particular presence in Ukraine because of the vacuum of power in the Civil War. I mean, there are historical and cultural and indeed religious reasons for why it's particularly acute in Ukraine. But the key factor here is the vacuum of power in Ukraine and the way in which military forces feel enabled to just move through entire communities and towns enacting the most extraordinary violence. And the one thing that the Bolsheviks succeed in doing better, actually, they are better at the military suppression of pogroms than they are the educative anti-racist work that we might call today around anti-Semitism. They bring a stop to this militarily quite quickly. The harder struggle they have is undoing the cultural work of anti-Semitism, the reservoir of anti-Semitism.
Brendan, we have a question from Agnes Corey, which I think your answer could imitate one of Lenin's speeches and go on for hours. But perhaps something brief on the relationship of Bolsheviks, socialists and Marxists in the Russian Revolution, sort of overlapping but not identical categories. Mm.
Thanks, Agnes. That's a really difficult question, and I'm not sure I'm able to give a fluent answer on the spot, but let me have a go. Lenin and party leaders and leaders of the Bund and of Marxist Zionism had a lot to say about these issues. But on the ground, these categories often meant very little to people. There's a terrific example I came across in the archives. I forget which region of Ukraine this was, but it was a town, it was a village where there was a Soviet reading group of some kind that existed, and the local peasants declared themselves to be revolutionaries and to be for Soviet power, but they didn't know what a Bolshevik was and they never heard of the Bolshevik party. So revolution and socialism meant something to them, but the categories of Bolshevik, non-Bolshevik, Menshevik, Bundist for them meant almost nothing. So we have to make a distinction between party leadership, who argued over the fine points of these categories, and other sections of the population for whom these categories often meant very little. For example, the infamous split between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, or the infamous split in the RSDLP in 1903, which led to the formation of the Mensheviks and the Bolshevik factions of the party, fractions of the party rather, often that meant nothing to workers in particular regions who continued to work together with their so-called enemies. So I hope that gives some semblance of an answer. But just one thing to say about the Jewish socialists that came through, often they considered themselves socialists and Marxists, and then eventually considered themselves Bolsheviks once they joined the party.
Brendan, we have quite a complex question from someone who didn't see episodes of The Prisoner in the 1970s, because he gives a name and not a number. And it's a question about Moshe Postona's work. And I hope the person who posed the question will forgive me if I rephrase it for you and simply ask you, what, if any, was the role of Moshe Postona's work on anti-Semitism, its influence on you as you undertook your work?
Thanks for that question. Again, it's a really great one, and you've almost second-guessed the book in some ways, because Moshe Postone's work was really crucial in for helping me to come up with, or to borrow just quite directly, his framework for making sense of the presence of anti-Semitism within movements for social justice. It doesn't map on completely to the Soviet period for obvious reasons. It's a historically very different context, but nevertheless, his kind of key finding, or one of his key arguments, which is that anti-Semitism can be appealing to some sections of some parts of the left because it offers an interpretation of the world and offers something of a kind of anti-hegemonic perspective of the movement of, I think he says, little people against impersonal forces of global domination. You find those tendencies absolutely to be in play in the context of the Russian Revolution. So I borrowed from Moshe's work and talk about him a little bit in the introduction to the book and in two or three other places as well. So yeah, I think his work is really helpful.
And here's a very different question, Brendan, from Pam Blakelock, who asks, how useful do you see your research to help in the fight against against rising racism internationally, especially in Eastern Europe? Don't we need to fight the trope that anti-capitalism is anti-Semitism?
Thank you for that, Pam. I do hope that this work is taken up within the context of Eastern Europe itself. I mean, this so much of that early Soviet history has gone forgotten and has been misremembered through very long and complicated sets of events in the Soviet and post-Soviet worlds. I would love it if I could uncover some of this history and if it could have meaning for those who are opposed to anti-Semitism and other forms of racism today in the lands in which the study is based, in Russia, Ukraine, and the former Pale of Settlement, where, of course, racism and anti-Semitism are very real to this day. Do we need to fight the trope that anti-capitalism is anti-Semitism? Well, it's a formulation that I absolutely do not use in this book. The perspective that I tried to develop in the introduction and then in the substantive chapters that follow is a different one, which comes from a question, which is why could anti-Semitism in some moments find traction within movements against capitalism and for social justice? And I hope in the talk I sort of gave a flavour of the perspective that I develop in those chapters, but I certainly do not... The takeaway from the book is not that anti-capitalism necessarily manifests in anti-Semitism, because it doesn't, but it can.
Thank you. We have a comment from Bina Rayner, which I'll just let stay in the chat because it's a comment and not a question, and move to Gad Lever's question, which is, did the Bolsheviks view Judaism as an ethnic group destined to disappear as socialism evolved?
Gosh, these are such difficult questions. I hope I can do them justice. The Bolshevik approach to the so-called Jewish question, as it was formulated at the time, the Yevreisky Vapros, was situated within a much broader approach to the national question more generally. And for leading Bolshevik theoreticians, the general approach was a dialectical one, which is to say, if the Bolsheviks could afford minorities a quite unprecedented degree of relative autonomy, of kind of cultural recognition, right up to and including state formation. Don't forget, the formation of the Soviet Union as 15 republics was a direct outcome of this perspective, which one historian, Terry Martin, called the affirmative action empire. So the Bolsheviks thought that by giving unprecedented recognition to minority mobilization, they would allow these forms of identification to run their historical course and reach something beyond nationality, beyond ethnicity. As I said, the idea was that it was dialectical. Here we are in 2020. People seem rather attached to those forms of identification to this day.
Well, we have a question from Nathan, which runs, given the centrality of anti-Semitism to Tsarist autocracy, is it accurate to posit that the pogroms under discussion highlight how difficult it is for any ideology to dislodge deeply ingrained societal prejudices? Perhaps another way of asking a similar question would be to ask you, Brendan, what were the differences between Tsarist pogroms and the pogroms after the revolution, which you deal with? Are we dealing with the same phenomenon, or are we dealing with a different phenomena?
Thank you for that, Nathan and David. I'm just rereading the question again. I think you're absolutely right, Nathan. The centrality of anti-Semitism to the social formation, it's the very social formation itself of late imperial Russia, made this a tremendously difficult problem for the Bolsheviks to tackle. And then you throw into the mix the trope and the anti-Semitic representation of Jewishness, the Judeo-Bolshevik construct. You throw that into the mix, and this makes it explosive for Bolshevism. So the Bolsheviks are responding to anti-Semitism from within, but they do so in the knowledge that they are bound up within the anti-Semitic projection. So in a sense, any step taken on this terrain is almost guaranteed to make the problem worse. And you can, just to give one kind of illustration of this, when left Zionists move into the Red Army, they ask for Red Army battalions that are Jewish only. And the Bolsheviks agonize over this. They say, well, on the one hand, this will be great because it will prove to the anti-Semites that Jews can fight, that they're strong and muscular and all the rest of it. It'll give a different representation of Jewishness. On the other hand, it might prove the anti-Semitic canard that Bolshevism is Jewish. And they just didn't know what to do about this. Eventually, they decided to set up these military units, and most of them were murdered in the pogroms. I mention this just to show how difficult this terrain was. And as Nathan, I think, has quite rightly said, this is significantly an outcome of the fact that the very social formation itself of late imperial, or by this point revolutionary Russia, was deeply sedimented with anti-Semitism. What you know, David and Ben Gidley and I have called in our work at the Peirce Institute, the reservoir of anti-Semitism was really spilling over in this moment. And actually, just one thing to say on this, the Jewish socialists, the non-Bolsheviks that came into the party, they recognized this. If one of the chapters, chapter 6 in the book, I talk about this campaign that Lipets, Rafez, and Chayfets, the three individuals you saw on your screen earlier, I talk about the campaign they developed in 1919. And it was in distinction to the Bolsheviks' one, which tended to understand the problem as being one of pogroms. So the Bolsheviks were opposed to pogroms, often significantly because they posed a threat to the Soviet state itself, not just to Jews. But Lipets, Rafez, and Chayfets, they said the problem is not just pogroms, but is anti-Semitism, the cultural conditioning of anti-Semitism, as they put it, that was deeply ingrained. So that is why they turned to drama groups, to schools, to theatre, to music productions, to universities, to children's schools, to Red Army reading groups. That was the site of anti-Semitism for them. This was about education and it was about culture. It was not reducible to pogroms. Anti-Semitism was more than pogroms. And I think they would have understood very well Nathan's point in the comment there. And I realize I'm going over a bit here, David. Sorry, there's lots of other questions here, isn't there?
Yes, we have one from Orlando, which I think is about other agencies combating anti-Semitism in the Red Army. So I think this is a question which is asking about the officer class in the army. Mm. So have you looked at the archives of Erevoen Soviet, the Red Army political divisions, the military committees of the Soviets, which were responsible for recruitment? The issue is not the prevalence of anti-Semitism among the soldiers. It was there in all the armies, but the orders and attitudes of the army's officers.
Thank you for that comment, Orlando. It's a comment from Orlando Figes, and I think it is anyway. I'm not sure. If it is Orlando Figes, thank you for that comment. I relied on your work to write this book and indeed to write about Red Army anti-Semitism. And I have looked at those archives and I tried to come to an understanding of the actions of what you describe as the attitudes of army officers and the kind of punishments that they enacted. It was highly uneven and dependent upon the nature of the composition of these units, of the individuals, the officers that were in position. I mean, of course, many of these officers had been former commanders and officials in the late Imperial Russian army as well. So the Bolsheviks could not always rely on them for taking the right position when it came to anti-Semitism. Some Red Army soldiers were indeed punished up to and including execution for their participation in pogroms, but others were not. There was one report I remember in particular, the military unit, I can't remember which one it was, but it's in the book. It's in chapter 5 of the book. The individual writes to the Bolshevik Central Committee and says, well, there's some anti-Jewish attitudes in the Red Army, you know, but it's not anti-Semitism. He says the Red Army soldiers get angered by the Jews because the Jew has the peasant by the throat. If only Jews can start to be more proletarian, I'm paraphrasing here, then the anti-Semitism will stop. So you can see actually how in this case, the anti-Semitism was not just from below, but in this case was all, you know, the Red Army officer was complicit as well. So it was uneven and dependent upon the composition of the units and the individuals who led those units. And I talk at some length about this in the book, but there was Red Army opposition to anti-Semitism, absolutely, just as there was Red Army anti-Semitism.
And lastly, I'm afraid this will have to be our last question because we're out of time. From Jeremy Hawthorne, when did the Commissariat produce pamphlets? Did the government promote them, obstruct them, or can one not tell?
Hi, thank you for that. Thank you for that, Jeremy. Yes, the government did welcome those pamphlets. There was a distinct lack of those pamphlets, and whenever the Jewish Commissariat produced them, they published them in large numbers. The trouble the Jewish Commissariat had was to try to shift the load. They often wrote to Lenin's government and said, 6 months ago, we asked for pamphlets to be written. We asked for newspaper articles in Pravda to be published on this, and there's been nothing. So they often found themselves in a position that unless they did the work themselves, little would happen. And that was not the case for the whole Russian Revolution, the whole of the period of the revolution. In 1919, especially in Ukraine, newspaper articles and pamphlets did indeed begin to appear. So the real trouble they had was in 1918 and in early 1919. In Ukraine in particular, but it was again like the answer to the last question. This was uneven. It depended on all sorts of external factors. Often these Jewish revolutionaries had to take up the work themselves. But each of the institutions that they set up, these committees to struggle against anti-Semitism, they were closed down through Bolshevik centralization, which in some ways brings us back to one of the first questions about the relationship between anti-Semitism and the Bolshevik centralization of power and the closing down of non-Bolshevik political organizations.
Well, thank you very much, Brendan. We're hugely, hugely indebted to you, and I'll say a word or two more about that in a moment. Before I do that, I'd like to thank all of you who are here for having come along. We had an extraordinarily large audience. I think almost 280 people here at its peak. I'd especially like to thank those of you who put such tremendous questions and taxing questions into the chat. I'd like to send my sincere apologies to any of you who didn't have your question posed. Brendan, you want to say something?
Sorry, I'm just scrolling through the questions and I see someone saying, how do I get a copy of the book? Can I just share some information on that?
Of course.
Blatant kind of self promotion or whatever you want to call it. I need to just find bear with me one moment. I'm sorry. I'm trying to find the screen that I wish to share. I have a 30% discount code, you see, that I want to share with everyone in case anybody would like to buy it. And it seems that there are one or two people in the, here we go. Sorry, everybody. If you go on to the Cambridge University Press website, they have a 30% discount just now. The code is on the screen. Are you able to see that, David?
Absolutely.
It's a, the code is 100091. So 1091. And if you go onto the Cambridge University Press website and type that in, you'll get the book with 30% off and free shipping. I think it comes to £16.
Well, I think everyone ought to go and buy half a dozen at that at that price. Well, despite that shameless plug for your book, Brendan, I really would like to thank you for a terrific, learned, magnificently well-structured, analytical, clear talk, and also for the engaged and hugely generous way in which you answered all of the questions. Really, thank you very much indeed for a fantastic hour and 10 minutes. Thank you to everyone who has come along. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and